everybody. I'm Dana Lawrence. I think you all know me. And this particular paper grew out of work I did to earn a master's in medical education, actually from the thesis work that was involved with that. And here's the problem that I was confronted with, or I think that our profession is confronted with. We have very little history within chiropractic of training our students, our faculty, or our clinicians in biomedical ethics. But whereas that's true, we're also confronted with the problem that we see a growing emphasis on training students and faculty in the practice of EBM. We're hitting our faculty pretty hard to be involved in scholarship and faculty development, and we expect them to be involved in research, whereas at the same time, studies in our profession have shown that few in our faculty actually are actively involved in research, yet we have this expectation that we want them to be doing it. So the objective of this particular project was to develop a core curriculum for teaching biomedical ethics to master's level students that are involved in the K30 program that we have at Palmer, which is a clinical master's program in clinical research, And it occurred to me during the time that I was working on this that because we're enrolling DCs in our program, what I'm doing in the master's program is also applicable to the DC faculty within Palmer and at other institutions, should they so desire, in order to enhance, you know, the research infrastructure within the institution. So this was a two-part mixed method study. In the first part of the study, I did qualitative research, conducting interviews using semi-structured questions. And in the second part, we did a survey that assessed faculty knowledge of institutional policies regarding how you conduct research and use IRBs at Palmer. So let me talk first about the part one. What I did was I interviewed four leaders with experience in ethics, teaching, or administration. I asked each of the people that I interviewed to consider a set of topics about bioethics, to add to, alter, or delete those topics, and then to provide a key learning objective for each of the final topics. I asked them to comment on best teaching methodologies for those topics, as well as some assessment methodologies, both in terms of assessing students and in terms of assessing the program overall, the overall success of the program. I coded the answers thematically. I used the responses to revise an existing program and derive a curriculum for a course in clinical bioethics. In the second part, what we did was we provided four separate scenarios involving educational research, and we asked all of the faculty at Palmer to select from one of three possible actions with regard to each of those scenarios. Their choices were to submit to the IRB, consult with the Human Protection Administrator or IRB Chair, or submit a conference abstract without prior approval. Now I need to step out of this just for a second to note that the policy at Palmer requires an initial submission to the Human Protections Administrator. The Human Protections Administrator at Palmer is empowered to make a decision as to whether or not a particular project is exempt. If the HPA decides that it's exempt, the faculty member is free to go and do their research. If, however, the Human Protections Administrator decides that it is not exempt, then a submission has to be made to the IRB. So under the policy, the first step in all research involving human subjects is to submit it to the Human Protections Administrator. This may differ from college to college. At other colleges, the functions of the Human Protections Administrator may be empowered within the chair of the IRB, for example. It just happens to address the fact that at Palmer we have a particular mechanism in place, which is a policy. The survey also asked respondents to select the people with whom they discussed ethical issues from a variety of different college positions. So we also gathered some data on where people were assigned, how long they'd been at the institution, and we also left one area blank for open-ended comments if they wished to sort of define why they answered in the way that they did. Categorical data was collected on an Excel spreadsheet. We just analyzed by frequency counts and percentages, and then the open-ended questions were just coded for theme and subject. All right. In the interview part of the project, essentially what happened was what you might expect. The responses from the people involved, Dr. Haas, for example, is one of the four people that I interviewed, provided guidance for the development of a course in clinical bioethics that relies heavily upon the use of case scenarios. and combines teaching and learning methodologies. And I'll show you an example of how this works in just a little bit. The curriculum for the program includes, for each topic of the course, for a course that only meets 1 hour per week, what I call a driving scenario around which classroom discussion takes place. We also ended up with a list of learning objectives, both cognitive and affective in nature, and suggested readings and an assignment for each section of the course. I happen to use a portfolio in this class. At the end of each week, the students in the class are provided some sort of an assignment. The assignment goes into the portfolio along with the literature that they collect, along with other literature that just they collect over time on topics that are interesting to them, and all of this is submitted at the end of the term. So they don't have assignments that are due on a weekly basis. They have this portfolio that they develop over the course of a term. Here's an example. So if we look at a particular unit on informed consent, the basic aim is that the graduate fellow will understand the required elements of a properly developed and legal informed consent form. So here's an example of a driving scenario. You've developed a survey which you intend to use in your class to provide you information about how the students in your class perceive your teaching style and your teaching methods. You conduct the survey with your class of 50 students, and the way you interpret the results, you alter the manner in which you teach. Next term, you do it again, leading you to make some more changes. And after a third time that you do the survey, your department chair suggests that maybe you want to prepare an abstract for an upcoming chiropractic educational conference. Please discuss the nature of informed consent throughout the conduct of all the surveys, as well as into the development of the conference abstract proceedings. And then we would allow, I'd have a dialogue with the students about this. Now, I actually had a little bit of a challenge this term, because in a class which I anticipate to be heavily derived around a give and take inside the classroom, I had, and with a cohort of only 4 students, 2 of my students came from cultures where talking in class is not something that they're comfortable with. So I had a little bit of a difficulty trying to use the driving scenario the past term, because I have 2 students who really don't want to get into the normal give and take that, for example, we might have or hope to have when we're all done talking here, and everybody wants to question everybody and get their little digs in and stuff like that. And that's normal, and we're all very comfortable with that, but not for my 2 students. So I had a little bit of a challenge in trying to draw them out and use the driving scenario to have the kind of discussions that I wanted to have. Learning objectives for this particular unit: on completion of the unit, they'd be able to define the elements of proper informed consent, which include information, understanding, voluntariness, and decision-making capacity. Describe the circumstances under which informed consent is not needed, that is, when would it be exempt. Compare and contrast the professional standard, the reasonable person standard, and the subjective standard with regard to how much information we give to patients. I mean, how much would be appropriate? What's the legal requirement for how much information that you give to people? If you use the professional standard, what the normal professional might tell somebody is nothing. And so, is that an appropriate standard? What's the reasonable person? The reasonable person is what some, arbitrary reasonable person might want to know. But I'm not a reasonable person, so I might want to know other things. And then we have the subjective standard, which is giving me enough information to satisfy me. What do we have in terms of legal requirements? What do we have in terms of moral requirements? This is what I want them to understand when they're done. Also, we'd want them to determine the level of understanding of a potential participant. That is, do they have the capacity to understand the information that they're being told and be able to present information to the patient at his or her ability to understand it, which is a real challenge. We have to write, for example, consent forms at different levels of understanding. If you're doing it for a standard consent, they usually require 8th grade. Some of the military work we've done have asked us to do it at a 6th grade level. So we have to be able to understand what it is we need to tell people, make sure that they can understand what we're telling them. Describe circumstances where patients do not have the ability to make appropriate decisions and know how to get consent from their surrogate, for example, with children or with the mentally impaired. Describe the concept of clinical equipoise and how it applies to the entry of human subjects into research projects, and demonstrate the ability to conduct an informed consent interview. In our program, all of our graduate fellows rotate through a variety of roles, including study coordinators, where they are involved in consent negotiations. And so we want them to have some comfort with presenting information to the patient, being able to answer questions, and be able to work through the process of obtaining a legal consent form. And I provide a list of learning materials. These are just an example of the types of learning materials, both web-based and paper-based, for them to look at. And then they would have for an example, an assignment. In this case, it's to read the paper by Childs and Fritz and to use that paper to write up a consent document. Okay. Unfortunately, where I have them in the sequence of courses is before they actually do their own independent projects. And that's part of our program, is to have them do two practicum projects where, of course, developing consent documents is going to be part of that. And, of course, they have to do that as part of their practicum projects. Unfortunately, they're not at a point where they can use their practicum projects to come up with a consent document, so I have them work off an existing paper just to make sure that they can get every proper element of a consent document into a form. Now, in the survey, the second part of what we did in the survey, the results indicated that faculty have a relatively poor understanding of the use of the institutional review boards in educational research, and this project dealt strictly with educational research, didn't deal with clinical trials or other forms of human subjects research. It dealt strictly with teaching faculty wishing to do some sort of educational project. We found that they basically did not understand when they needed to seek what kind of approvals from whom. For the four scenarios that we gave them, the highest correct response for any question was 41%. Many faculty members automatically assume that they are to submit to the IRB, which again, at Palmer is not the case. They have to go to the Human Protections Administrator first. Okay, and they also don't always understand when things are exempt. We also found that few people actually discuss ethical issues with anyone, and when they do, it's largely with their own colleagues, who don't have much better understanding than they do. Most of the faculty were unaware of the college policy. The highest percentage of respondents in the survey had more than 10 years of service, and we had about a 55% response rate. Now, this was an outgrowth of my course of study in the Master's of Medical Education program at University of Dundee, and it did end up creating a new curriculum, basically, for teaching bioethics, which I used for the first time this last term. The work also became a little bit more important when it coordinated with institutional needs to enhance faculty scholarship. I've actually developed I did a faculty in-service based on some of this work to try to go over some of the issues that the survey came up with to make sure that our faculty had a better understanding of what they needed to do. So it has application not just to our master's students, but it's adaptable for use within various settings inside the institution, and also, you know, if there were interest outside the institution for CE. The need for understanding ethical and underpinnings of research has never been greater. Now, we have both legal and moral needs that we have to meet when we use human subjects in research settings, and we can't afford to violate them. I was at a good clinical practices program about a month and a half ago where I learned exactly what the repercussions are for violating these things, and you don't want to. You don't want to get a letter from the government saying that you've violated the law, because that's what you're doing. Well, you know, our chiropractic education may be sort of a small fish in a big pond, but we tend to do things better than a lot of people think we should, and we need to pay a lot more attention to the ethical side of what we're doing. I want to also give some props to Dr. Maria Hondris, who worked with me on the survey, and note that the project was conducted in a facility constructed with support from the Research Facilities Improvement Grant. And I thank you all very much.